Good morning, good afternoon to all our listeners. Thank you for joining us today. You are listening to the Energy Transition Now series, and I'm your host, Joyce Gregory, Head of Hydrogen for the Westwood Global Energy Group. We hope that you've been enjoying listening to the Hydrogen podcast series so far. We've been talking about funding hydrogen technology, hydrogen's potential role in the gas grid, as well as some of the challenges that we're seeing around scaling up electrolyzer technology. Today is the last of the series, and we're going to be talking about enabling the global hydrogen economy. But before I start, I'd like to kick off by introducing my lovely co-host, Jun Sasamura. He's a senior analyst on Westwood's hydrogen team. Please say hello.
Hello, everyone.
So today, Jun and I will be joined by David Burns, who's VP of Clean Energy at Linde. David's been with the company since 2005 and has been heavily involved in developing its hydrogen business. So today we have the pleasure of drawing on his wealth of experience and knowledge in this space. David, it's great to have you here today.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to join you today. Thanks, Joyce.
So firstly, I'd like to start off by asking you to give a little bit of background on Linde, because there will be some of our listeners who might be a little bit less familiar with the company and the work that it's doing in the hydrogen space.
Sure. You mentioned I joined Linde in 2005. Actually, I joined Praxair in 2005, and then Linde and Praxair merged in 2019. So that was kind of the evolution of the largest industrial gas company in the world at that point was 2019 with the merger of Linde and Praxair. Praxair, US-based, and Linde was a German-based company. So they came together, formed the world's largest industrial gas company. Industrial gases, you know, from our perspective, you know, that's oxygen, nitrogen, argon, and other kind of specialty gases associated with, you know, the atmosphere, you know, recovering those gases from the atmosphere, and also process gases, which is hydrogen and CO2. Obviously, that's very topical today, hydrogen and CO2, but that's kind of a business we've been involved in, hydrogen for, you know, decades, years plus, developed into a $3 billion business today for us around hydrogen. Also, we have a large CO2 business, a CO2 capture business for recovering CO2, purifying it, and then supplying that to the merchant market. So not sequestration, which obviously the large volumes of CO2 capture and sequestration we'll be talking about, but very familiar with hydrogen, but also with CO2. So those two things are coming together to really, you know, put us in a good position here as we try and enable the energy transition. You know, those are the two key areas that we kind of leveraging our expertise, capabilities, and technologies. So that's Linde today, you know, the world's largest industrial gas company, but came through the merger of Praxair and Linde.
I see. Thanks for the clarification. So you've been working specifically in hydrogen since 2005. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So of course, back in those days, it was all around conventional or grey hydrogen. You know, that was yeah, we weren't really thinking of clean hydrogen at that point. Obviously, a lot of grey hydrogen or conventional hydrogen was used in the production of clean fuels, you know, low sulfur diesel in particular, as well as the feedstock in chemicals. But a lot of the growth, you know, from the early 2000 onwards was really meeting these low sulfur fuel standards and producing hydrogen to meet that. And that's how we built out, you know, a very large network, certainly on the U.S. Gulf Coast, to supply the refineries there. And then more recently, you know, with this focus on the transition, energy transition, and the role that hydrogen can play in that, you know, we're really looking to leverage that capability and infrastructure to really lean into now producing clean hydrogen in all its forms. We probably heard a lot about the colors, the greens and the blues, et cetera. But we tend to focus on the, you know, what is the carbon intensity, focus on that, what, you know, and talk about clean hydrogen from that perspective. But we can use that same infrastructure, pipelines, trucks, et cetera, and production facilities, and kind of leverage that to then start providing clean hydrogen to those end users who are needing it.
So how has that transition actually happened then? Like, how are you focusing much more, leveraging your infrastructure to go from gray to blue or green? What's been happening over the last year or so?
Yeah, you know, so we've been looking at, you know, we have a large production base of grey hydrogen, and we're looking at some opportunities to convert that to blue by capturing the CO2 and sequestering it. At the same time, we're also looking at building new facilities to produce blue hydrogen, you know, where it makes sense, and, you know, connecting that into our network. From our perspective, you know, when looking at clean hydrogen, you know, we see that with blue hydrogen, that can be done at scale today. You know, that's the technologies and the capabilities of producing blue hydrogen at scale at a cost which is not too different than that of gray. I mean, there's a small premium, but we can make blue hydrogen and its derivatives at fairly competitive cost to gray. And certainly if you're looking in the US, you know, you can produce blue hydrogen cheaper in the US today than you can produce gray hydrogen in Europe, just given the cost differential in underlying natural gas. So we've been looking at blue hydrogen as being really a stepping stone into clean energy and maybe green hydrogen in the future. The challenge with green hydrogen, you know, produced with electrolysis is, you know, for all intents and purposes, green hydrogen electrolysis, it's kind of a nascent industry. That technology is not there at scale today. You know, we're working to develop projects and gradually build up a scaling electrolysis there. But a key part of the cost stack there, of course, is renewable energy as well, renewable power. So we can do our best to drive the cost of electrolysis down, but the underlying cost factor, renewable energy, still has been creeping up. So, you know, we're looking at blue hydrogen, do that at scale today, leverage the infrastructure we've developed around gray, and then, you know, step into green hydrogen and renewable power-based production of hydrogen in the future. So we kind of, it's a two-pronged approach, but we can do blue hydrogen at scale today. That's the difference. I mean, put it in context, you know, you're looking at one of the world scale hydrogen plants we're developing, blue hydrogen plants, the equivalent scale in electrolysis may be 1 or 2 gigawatts. And, you know, there's really not the manufacturing capacity on the electrolysis side to do that today. You know, we've seen, I think the largest project built to date is probably in China with Sinopec, about 250 megawatts. Ourselves, we've been building projects in Leuna. We have a 24 megawatt project we're commissioning. We have a 35 megawatt project we're developing in Niagara Falls in the US based on hydropower. So that's kind of the scale we're at today, which is obviously an order of magnitude less than you can do with blue, 1 or 2 orders of magnitude less. So we're looking at blue, you know, hydrogen produced with CCS as being really the way to drive uptake of clean hydrogen. And that'll create the opportunity for green to come in as the cost position the technology develops.
Interesting. So one of the things I wanted to kind of start to bring out here was starting to focus on specifically the main projects that Linde are focused on now. And you were talking sure. about how perhaps now, given the ability to leverage or obviously the current capability, current infrastructure, yeah. it seems to be tend to be more blue focused. So
yeah.
I mean, I'm leaning towards, you know, the larger projects that we are aware of at the moment, say, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico with OCI, that big blue ammonia project, you know, partnerships with Saudi Aramco to develop ammonia cracking technology. So would you be able to perhaps run through in some more detail around some of the key projects, especially in the blue hydrogen yeah. space?
Yeah, and obviously, you know, you're talking about OCI, it's a great example of kind of the scale, the projects to scale we can develop today. And that's, you know, OCI is looking to develop about a 3,100 ton a day clean ammonia project on the US Gulf Coast near Beaumont. We're building new ATR capacity, autothermal reforming capacity, to produce the blue hydrogen that they need to produce that ammonia. We're also supplying the nitrogen as well that's needed. So, we'll be providing that. They'll be then building the loop and producing ammonia. So we're building all the infrastructure that is required to produce and distribute hydrogen and nitrogen to them. So that's, you know, obviously a world-scale ammonia train, blue clean ammonia train that OCI is developing. So I think that's obviously an example of a project that's also been enabled in many ways by the IRA in terms of its 45 Q credits. In this case, we're working, I think we announced we're working with Exxon. They'll be doing the TNS on the CO2. So we'll produce the hydrogen, capture the CO2, and then Exxon will be our partner there to take that and sequester it. Another project, large project working on us up in Canada, I think Dow announced that they'd selected us to work with them on helping decarbonize their Fort Saskatchewan facility. That'd be a great example of fuel switching, where, you know, off gas from the ethylene cracker and natural gas, you convert that to hydrogen and capture the CO2 in the process, and then use the hydrogen in the furnace, you know, in the high temperature furnace in the steam cracker. So that's a great way to decarbonize the facility there. So we're working with Dow on that. In the Middle East, in Saudi, we have a partnership, a global partnership with SLB, you know, former Schlumberger, to help us provide a kind of end-to-end CCS capability. So we're working in that case with SLB and Aramco in a JV to develop CCS or carbon capture storage for the kingdom there, in which we'll be capturing in the first phase 9 million tons a year of CO2 from a number of industrial sources, including some hydrogen and ammonia. You know, we're looking out to, by the end of the phase three, if it goes all the way through the end of the third phase, it's something like 54 million tons a year of CO2 will be captured. So in that case, it's not all CO2 associated with hydrogen by any means. It's from other industrial sources. And again, it'll be a, you know, make a significant contribution to helping decarbonize the economy there in Saudi. So again, that's a nice project where you know, ourselves and SLB and Aramco coming together to develop a carbon capture project. That's one thing we're finding in clean energy in general, by the way, is this, you know, where in the past we'd have tend to do projects by ourselves. Now we're looking at partnerships and bringing in different partners with different capabilities, different. And that's also, you know, one of the things we're noticing as we go forward here with clean energy is this kind of coming together of different partners with their different skills to really make projects happen. So those are kind of some of the large projects we're looking at, you know, carbon capture and blue hydrogen related. A lot of other projects in the pipeline. I think we have something like a little over 200 projects that we have in our pipeline. We expect that to, you know, translate into about $10 billion of capital expended over the next 10 years or so. Over the next 2 to 3 years. When you look at the probability weighting all those projects, it comes to about $10 billion. So that's kind of the pipeline we have right now. But we're also expecting over the next 10 years or so that, you know, we'll probably be looking at projects in the $50 billion range that we'll be kind of participating in. So that's kind of the scale of the opportunity for us we see here in clean energy. So that's, you know, obviously a lot of large blue projects. Right now, there's some smaller green projects we're developing. I mentioned the 35 megawatt project up in Niagara Falls, 24 megawatts in Leuna in Germany there. So that's kind of the scale we're at there. At the same time, we're working on some other projects to try and help drive demand as well. You know, we're working with Daimler in Europe to look at liquid fueling of trucks, heavy trucks. Last year, we announced, I think it's 14 trains in Bremerwerder in northern Germany, where we'll be supplying hydrogen-powered trains. And there's even a ferry in Norway, which will be using hydrogen. So we're kind of helping drive the demand side as well, which I think, mm-hmm. you know, to be honest, is one of the gaps right now is not so much the production side, it's the demand side, which is needing some little push and needs some help as well.
So you mentioned those, I guess, in the context of green hydrogen, slightly more mobility focused. And I know with the, you know, recent announcements of the 7 hydrogen hubs in the US that Linde is involved in, the California hydrogen hub, which also seems to be more mobility focused. Is that, so are there different strategies for, say, you know, tackling the green hydrogen market for Linde? It seems to be quite different when you're comparing blue versus green there.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think green hydrogen, particularly in Europe, there's a focus on using green hydrogen, for want of a better word, in the mobility sector, and certainly under, you know, under RE2, et cetera, the need to, find sources of green hydrogen to support the build out of particularly mobility. particularly in the heavy truck area, right? Whereas in the US, it seems to be, you know, more of a focus right now on blue at large scale. But then, as you said, with the hubs, there are some in those different hubs which have been announced, there are some green hydrogen production as well. And so we're looking at, you know, being able to support that market as well. As you mentioned, we're in the Archers hub. We have a production facility right now in Ontario, California, where we produce some green hydrogen. We're looking to produce more there as well. And that will help, you know, obviously, with the build out in the California market. And when we look at Europe and Germany in particular, you know, we've been, I think we have over 200 fueling stations have been built. Well, we as Linde, through our affiliate Hydrogen Fuel Tech, Linde Hydrogen Fuel Tech, you know, we design and build fueling stations. We've built something like 200 fueling stations around the world right now, you know, which will help fuel vehicles. In Germany itself, we're over 100 fueling stations there. Been installed as part of the venture with H2 Mobility. It's a venture of a number of companies, including ourselves, to build out fueling stations. The idea was that, I think we all know the chicken and egg problem. You know, what comes first, the fueling stations or the vehicles? So there's a number of companies, ourselves and Daimler and Shell, etc., came together and decided to build out fueling stations to pull through the vehicles, you know, so we've built over 100 stations now. Must admit, there aren't that many vehicles, but I think we're looking at, you know, obviously at that time it was more focused on cars, but I think the future is heavy trucks and heavy vehicles. So we're hoping to see that grow.
I imagine, you know, the new, you know, initiative for, you know, that TENT network to develop that refueling infrastructure network in Europe is helping also enable that even further.
Yeah, and I think. And the key thing right now is to get trucks on the road, right? That is the key exactly. thing in Europe is to, that's ultimately the demand point is the trucks. And so I think we're poised to start seeing trucks, you know, arrive in greater numbers. Obviously, I think there's 50 Hyundai trucks in Switzerland right now. We're part of a venture called HydroSpider, which is supplying hydrogen to those vehicles. But that's kind of the largest scale at the moment. I think there's been other announcements around different initiatives to put trucks on the road. That's the key thing right now in the mobility sector.
We've touched on a number of markets and how perhaps the strategies may be different across these geographies. What I'm curious about is kind of your understanding of how perhaps there are different trends across these markets. So say, you know, starting to, you know, dive deeper into comparing the US to Europe to even the Middle East, as Linde does have positions in all of these markets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe starting with, you know, we mentioned the IRA earlier, but if you could expand on kind of the impact of that, and especially with so much money injected with recent hydrogen hubs, as I mentioned earlier, and how you see the market in the US trending.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think of the IRA and the hubs as part of the BIL. A lot of stimulus there, a lot of you know, focus on production. You see opportunities in fuel switching, and we also see mobility kind of building. But right now, a lot of focus on developing export projects, particularly around ammonia, produce clean ammonia for export. So that's a lot of the focus in the US right now, and there's really a lot of momentum behind that. You know, as you look in Europe, I think what we're waiting for there is, you know, some it is, again, mobility, but also particularly a focus on steel and cleaning up the steel industry in terms of their CO2 emissions, their intensity per ton of steel produced. The focus there seems to be a lot around DRI, you know, direct reduction of iron as kind of the path forward there. I mean, it's, you know, obviously a global initiative, not just Europe, but a lot of folks in Europe about DRI. So really, we're waiting for the industry to make large investments to be able to convert to that kind of steel making process, which will then pull hydrogen through. So, you know, a little bit of waiting for the investment being made to really pull through a lot of hydrogen. Obviously, in Europe also, we see fuel switching. We also see some power projects being developed. Part of the challenge in Europe is, you know, it's difficult, certainly in mainland Europe, with sequestration, that is challenging. If you're looking at producing blue hydrogen as derivatives, if you're in the North Sea basin, you know, the UK, Netherlands, Norway, etc., you can look at offshore sequestration. But it does add an extra layer of cost when you have to, you know, deliver CO2 to the North Sea ports to then deliver it by pipe or by ship to the fields for sequestration. So that's one of the challenges in Europe, is this concern around blue hydrogen, its derivatives, producing it locally. First of all, the gas is expensive. It's expensive to sequester it, and much more focus on green energy. Green hydrogen. The challenge there is getting the power, renewable power, at the availability you need, and also at the cost you need. But so that's on the demand, on the production side. But you know, we're also still waiting for the demand side to start picking up as well.
Just if I can ask you on that point, because we had a podcast, the first of the series was actually with Michelle Robson from AP Ventures, and they are a venture capital firm that invest in early stage technologies or also established technologies, and looking at, you know, improving efficiencies of those. So ammonia cracking, or, you know, as a new technology, or electrolysis, trying to boost the efficiencies. Mm. And one of the comments that she made was around, you know, if she looked across the entire value chain, which they do invest in, that actually it's the midstream that she feels is the area that requires probably the most concentration, I guess, if you want to say that, in terms of investment now. And her quote was something like, if we invest in the midstream, then that unlocks other areas of the value chain. And I was wondering if you agree with that or not, because it seems as though you're, Linde, are again working across the entire value chain. You're not only building the infrastructure, but you're working on the demand side, and you're talking about some of the challenges in terms of sequestration, which is, I guess, you know, production side, power, renewables. Yeah. That's also on the production side. So, would you agree with her comment to say that actually the most important investment opportunity that needs to be made now should be in the midstream, or do you think there's something else?
No, I mean, my perspective is demand side, which needs the most stimulus at the moment to get the demand side growing. You know, get some opportunities developed, capacity developed, which will take hydrogen at that, you know, clean hydrogen at the premiums required to make it work. On the midstream, I presume she's thinking about the pipelines and distribution. You know, our perspective is, you know, we have pipelines in the US. I think we have about 1,000 kilometers around the world of hydrogen pipelines, so we can, you know, build that infrastructure if needed to get it to our customers. So that's not a challenge. The challenge will be, there were some new customers developing, we're not currently connected to a grid or to a network. So you have to look at building out new pipelines, which can be challenging, you know, given the permitting requirements, et cetera. I think converting the natural gas grid, to hydrogen, such as they're looking at in Europe with the hydrogen backbone, I think will help solve a lot of those issues. There's some opportunities, you know, when you're looking at fueling stations needing, you know, 4 or 5 tons a day of hydrogen, you probably won't build pipelines to connect. So what you're looking at there, I think, is liquid hydrogen and using liquid hydrogen to solve that problem. And that technology is available today. You know, I think we as Linde, we have over half the world's capacity of liquid hydrogen today. We use that to distribute hydrogen to customers who are needing more than tube trailer amounts, which is what, half a ton to a ton a day on a truck. If you're looking at liquid, you can put 4 to 5 tons on a truck, and you can use that to kind of really optimize the supply chain and start helping on the mobility side, kind of those kind of applications develop. On the larger scale, like mills, et cetera, the quantities they're requiring, it makes, you know, a lot of sense to build the pipelines, build pipelines needed to get that kind of quantity, either build new pipelines or you repurpose existing pipelines. So I think as the demand grows, the midstream will fill in to commit that. And so I don't think it's midstream holding it up. It's the demand holding it up, and then the midstream and the infrastructure will follow. The great thing is there's a lot of, you know, given the business we have today around gray hydrogen, we have a lot of infrastructure and capability we can leverage today to provide clean hydrogen as well. So I, not to completely disagree, but I think the issue is more on the demand side and making sure that gets moving, and then the infrastructure and the midstream will kind of follow.
Okay, and then on the demand side, you mentioned that the US is focusing on exporting ammonia.
Yes.
They're focusing on the European market, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the European market coming to Northern Europe, Germany, Netherlands, et cetera, Rotterdam, et cetera, that's one focus for certainly the Gulf Coast projects. I think obviously in Asia, Japan, Korea, they're also looking at particularly ammonia as a solution to decarbonizing the power sector, co-firing with ammonia or using ammonia directly. And so we'll see some ammonia going across the Pacific into Asia. I think we'll see a lot of clean energy coming out of Australia as well, coming into Korea and Australia, in Korea and Japan. In that case, you know, thinking further out, it may not be ammonia, it may be liquid hydrogen. And I think, you know, we're looking at developing that capability of being able to export, you know, develop export quantities of capabilities. The hundreds and, you know, 400 or 500 tons a day kind of capacity, and not the 30 to 50 tons a day that we see today for liquid hydrogen. So I think liquid hydrogen may be a decade away, but right now ammonia is the vector for moving clean energy.
Why do you think the US is focusing on the export markets first, rather than decarbonizing their own domestic market?
I think there's two things. Well, you know, we're looking at projects in the US, which are also like fuel switching projects in particular, like mobility, which will decarbonize the US economy, help decarbonize. We're looking at projects, steel projects, which will also help decarbonize the steel sector. But I think when you look at the US and, you know, we're looking at export, and you need large quantities, large scale to make export markets work. You have the combination of abundant low-cost natural gas, sequestration opportunities close by, and the capability of market and construction market that's able to build large-scale billion-dollar-plus projects. That all comes together to make, and with the infrastructure in place for export, you know, the ports, the storage systems, et cetera, all that's in place to make it a great export. Kind of, instead on the Gulf Coast, is going to be a great export opportunity going to develop there. So it's not much focused on ammonia. It's a combination of all these factors that make producing product for export out of the US Gulf Coast to be very attractive. We just look at the cost of gas in Europe versus the gas on the Gulf Coast. You can look at making blue hydrogen today, blue ammonia on the Gulf Coast at a lower cost, and you can produce gray ammonia in Europe. So it also removes one of the risk factors is who will pay a premium for blue ammonia. If you can produce it at lower cost, then there's always the ability to use that in place of gray production in Europe. So I don't so much in a focus on exports, it's just that it makes it for a very good export, great location to make product for export. But certainly the US is very much focused on decarbonizing its own economy, the IRA and the BIL, very much helping towards that as well.
And so what do you think is, if demand is that part of the value chain that needs a bit more support, what do you think would help drive that? Is it the, you mentioned the premium, is it subsidies? Is it policy? What do you think is really needed on the demand side?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is policy driven. you know, certainly in Europe, when you look at the combination of the ETS and CBAM, that's going to create the kind of right environment for seeing demand for decarbonization and clean hydrogen in Europe. You know, the challenge in the US, of course, you know, is we have very good policies in place for subsidizing and producing, helping produce low cost clean energy. On the demand side, you know, with no carbon taxes, et cetera, is much a carrot rather than a stick. So I think policy is also drawing it to a more kind of a production-based push. In Europe, there's also a combination, you're getting into a combination of helping on the production side, but also helping on the demand side with a bit of a pull. The challenge, of course, in Europe as well is, you know, when you look at the IRA, it's a very simple structure. You get into Europe and you've got a very complex web of different policies and different programs that you have to navigate. So a lot of money is being made available to support projects in the US, which can be tapped very quickly, very simply. In Europe, a lot of money potentially available. It's just more difficult to tap into that because of the process and the bureaucracy around you know, applying for funding. It tends to be more kind of CapEx based funding in Europe, whereas in the US it's more kind of OpEx based through tax credits. You know, I think we're waiting for the final IRS rulings on around the production tax credit side, but I think it's very well understood. It's a bit more challenging in Europe.
You mentioned those challenges in Europe, you know, around varying policies, you know, across the EU. Do you think in that sense then Europe is potentially falling behind, you know, say compared to the US, or do you think they're still on track? It just needs to get to that stage, which we're waiting for, is that bit more clarification, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Europe, there is, you know, great ambition, you know, such as, you know, 20 million tons a year of hydrogen and clean hydrogen derivatives by 2030. You know, in some ways, you know, a little bit ahead of the US, right? I think their roadmap was 10 million tons by 2030, you know, building up to, I think it's 40 million tons by 2050. You look at the roadmap in, so they both have a roadmap to really, you know, increase the amount of hydrogen, clean hydrogen that's going to be used in the economy. I think when you look at large scale projects, more have been announced in the US, especially, you know, in the last 12 months since the IRA was passed, than in Europe. So a little bit of a slower process. And I think Europe's definitely leading up to the point the IRA was passed. But now we're seeing the US kind of pulling ahead a little bit. And, you know, certainly with the hubs being announced as well, that's obviously, you know, further increasing that kind of moving the US ahead even more, I think, than Europe. But I think Europe has the ambition and the, you know, the policies and desire to kind of decarbonize. It's just been challenging in many ways to kind of access the funding would help support that.
So do you think that is really the key in order to help drive that forward in Europe?
Yeah, and I think as we see, you know, the ETS and CBAM, as that comes through, I think that's going to help drive a lot of kind of uptake and new applications requiring clean hydrogen to as we move forward here. So I think those have been set in motion now, and we'll start to see the impact over the next few years. It's just with the simplicity of the production of the tax credit under IRA, it's helped projects get moving more quickly, should we say, in the US. So I think the momentum is there in Europe. It's just been a bit slower to see develop.
We talked a little bit about the funding being a key component, but we're also going back to your previous point around partnerships, and obviously this is something that you're seeing here. Partnerships has been, more of an emerging trend that we're seeing in old projects, right? Because you can't fill all the gaps yourself. And by developing that partnership, you're obviously diversifying the risks a little bit. And that's what's really helping some of these larger scale projects kind of get off the ground. Would you agree with that, that partnerships is also pretty key?
Definitely, yeah. I think we view partnerships as definitely being key. You know, it's while we address the full value chain, there's certain parts of the value chain that are new. Certainly on the demand side around fueling of trucks and things like that. That's a developing area. We haven't really seen that in the past. You know, DRI in the steel industry. You know, we're very from the steel industry, supply a lot of oxygen argon to steel. Steelmakers, so we're very, you know, we have strong relationships with other steel companies. We understand challenges they're faced with as they look to decarbonize, and so we can work with them in partnership to help. But again, it's bringing to collective, a kind of collective knowledge from different partners coming together to really help kind of drive a transition, help the decarbonization. I think it makes it a lot faster if you choose the right partner who've got the right technology, who can help fill those kind of gaps that are developing. So no, I think partnerships are going to be key going forward, and they are today. I mean, when you look at some of the projects we're working on, you know, partnerships have been key to that, whether it's working with Daimler on liquid fueling of trucks, or whether it's working with SLB and Aramco on the CCS project in Saudi. You know, it's very, very key to our whole kind of focusing clean energy going forward.
Okay, well, thank you very much, David. I think if we kind of sum up that, there's still a lot of challenges on the supply side, right? Looking at power requirements, looking at sequestration. Yeah. Linde is focusing all across the value chain from that production side, providing the infrastructure, helping with demand. Really, it's the demand side that you're saying needs that extra stimulus now. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we when we look at it, we look across the whole value chain. We don't see production of clean hydrogen as being the issue. Clean hydrogen and its derivatives. We can do that at scale today. When we look at blue hydrogen, blue ammonia, we can do that at scale today. The technologies, the capabilities are in place. When we look at producing hydrogen through electrolysis and renewable energy, we need the manufacturing capacity to build up for electrolyzers. We need the cost to come down, and which it will as scale builds. But you know, we look at 75% of the cost being based on renewable power. We need to start seeing the cost for renewable power to come down. When you look at a project, so you don't end up putting in either more power capacity or more electrolyzer capacity than you really need just to be able to capture the kind of peaks and troughs of renewable power production. Some more kind of help from a policy side around how you can get high availability rates, help drive the cost down from a CapEx point of view, and help drive the overall cost of the hydrogen produced down as well. So I think there is a case to be made that a bit more flexibility around how renewable power is considered and how it's how it can be used. So whether it's temporal correlation, availability, additionality, etc. Those are some of the things which also can be a bit challenging when you look at putting a green clean hydrogen project together. And so that's something we hadn't really addressed before. But that's maybe where there can be some help as well.
Okay. All right. Well, I think there's still a lot of work to be done in this hydrogen industry, particularly as we see some of the challenges in offshore wind and some of the auctions and the rising cost of inflation and the cost of those projects. So, we're hoping that, some of the challenges that we're seeing there aren't going to be too much of a hindrance for the takeoff of the green hydrogen industry.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, David. I've really enjoyed the conversation. We're nearly out of time here, but I think I speak on behalf of all of our listeners that we really value your insights.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. And I think hopefully got the message across that, you know, Lindy is focused on decarbonizing our own operations, but also helping customers decarbonize as well. And you know, we're bringing to bear our, you know, our capabilities around producing hydrogen, you know, decades of production of hydrogen safely and reliably, being able to bring that to bear when it comes to working with new customers, new partners who've not been in the hydrogen space, not needed hydrogen before, but will need it going forward. So we think that in that way, we can help with the transition, the energy transition here, and help ourselves with a lot of growth opportunities, but also help our customers and society as a whole reach their decarbonization goals.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. And I hope all of our listeners have enjoyed hearing some of your insights. And this closes the end of our hydrogen podcast series. We hope that you've enjoyed. And please make sure you subscribe, and we will see you next time. Thank you very much.